Life sure gets busy, doesn't it? Well, we understand. With all the certifications you have, finding the right kind of continuing education that fits your schedule can be a real challenge. That's where the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription comes in. For less than $5 a month, the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription gives you top-notch accredited CE while you listen. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information or to sign up today. The FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription, another way we're being your partner in discovery.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today's podcast is going to be a nightmare series podcast, and I have Bruce Hoffman. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, man.
So we are currently in Austin, Texas, about to start teaching the next 4 days. We're doing two back-to-back FPC and CCP-C courses for Austin EMS Association, and we flew in this morning or this early this afternoon and sitting down and doing this podcast.
It's been a great trip. We got here safe. Just got back from In-N-Out Burger to get some to get some good eats, and I got to tell you, you left me hanging. I had to hear from Brother Verkest that there's some French fries there called animal fries that are pretty good. I got to tell you, you only gave me the regular fries. Not too happy about that.
We're gonna but have to I'm going to take you to Terry Black's.
See, all right. So that totally makes it. That totally does it. Can't wait. We're meeting up with one of our mentorship applicants who's now working with us for the next year as a participant in our mentorship program, Nathan Smith. And we're going to join him at Terry Black's, I hear. So I'm ready for some good Texas barbecue.
Nice. So let's get started. Why don't you introduce the case?
So this is a patient who is 33-year-old female with a history of anxiety, ADHD, and polysubstance abuse. She was brought to the emergency department by EMS for altered mental status, agitation, and rapid respirations. The patient has her husband here with her, and he says that she's always anxious and has started to feel sick since last night. That's the case.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things with this case. You know, you have somebody with history of substance abuse brought in by EMS. I mean, this is a standard EMS call that I'm sure as a listener you've had hundreds and hundreds of these. So I think the important thing about this case as we move through is this is one of the most lethal overdoses that you can see. It's definitely not the number one killer. We've already talked about that acetaminophen is the number one killer out there. But the problem with this overdose is that it is often missed, and the way these patients present, by the time it's maybe truly diagnosed, it's too late, right? Just the toxic levels are so high. So the medication we're talking about is aspirin overdose, ASA, acetylsalicylic acid. And so let's go into some medications. Obviously, aspirin itself, you know, when I think about having aspirin at our house, we don't have aspirin at our house, but we know that there are lots of patients out there that have baby aspirin. Maybe they take that for different reasons. Maybe it's a, you know, cardiac-related problem. Maybe it's a clotting disorder type of thing. But what other medications can we see an aspirin component to?
Absolutely. And that's a great point that you bring up, which is we tend to have aspirin all over the place. For the non-educated person, aspirin is really touted as an over-the-counter medication, and its dangers are not thoroughly explained to the lay person, which makes an overdose on this medication very dangerous because people don't realize how dangerous it is. There was just a study that came out that demonstrated that people who were regularly taking aspirin over the counter on a daily basis with a non-significant cardiac history, so no significant cardiac history, was actually proven to not be good. So they're actually asking people to step away from that. That's just some new literature that came out. So I think that that's the first pearl, is that medication, aspirin, is very dangerous and people don't realize that. So some of the medications that contain aspirin are Pepto-Bismol. So Pepto-Bismol, again, an over-the-counter drug that contains aspirin. And then something called methyl salicylate. And this is wintergreen oil, or oil of wintergreen. Again, in probably some more rural areas, you would see this maybe being used in even a naturopathic setting or in some of those rural areas. When you look at oil of wintergreen, it's not traditionally dosed out in caplets or tablets. It's typically in milliliters. And in this case, 1 ml of wintergreen oil is equal to 1,400 milligrams of aspirin. So 1.4 grams of aspirin.
That is massive.
That is a lot of aspirin.
It is, yeah. So obviously with this patient, 33-year-old, again, polysubstance abuse, aspirin is just one of the medications. I mean, altered mental status, agitation, rapid respiration. So I think the key thing, what I always highlight in any of the courses we take, is trying to remember, and I don't know if I just learned this. I think I had some pretty phenomenal instructors over my time, but to try to remember key words. You know, if I'm assessing a patient with cardiac chest pain and they say, I have right shoulder pain, I'm automatically going gallbladder. But I'm still going to do a differential and try to rule out, you know, a cardiac-related type of a thing.
Absolutely.
If somebody says it hurts when I breathe, right, you're still thinking maybe pleuritic type of a pain, but you're still ruling out and going down the road of cardiac. If somebody has rapid respirations, even though we teach that's always the first stage of shock, That's not, if it's continuous like that, there's a reason.
Absolutely.
Right? So why is somebody in a state of rapid respirations? That just doesn't fit. And the one of the first ones you always think of is an aspirin overdose.
Absolutely.
Right? And we're going to get into the physiology, the pathophysiology, right? So physiology, the normal state, pathophysiology, the abnormal state, why that happens as we move through this case. So when we go back to the case, patient is anxious, tachycardic, tachypneic. Airway is patent, intact. Neuro exam is non-focal. She is a little bit agitated, as we said before. Mental status is altered. She's moaning. She's cursing. She's obviously a little bit intoxicated or appears intoxicated. Skin is diaphoretic, and she has vomit on her chest. So obviously, in this case, we have to evaluate airway management concerns. As we've said before, we don't really look at the mentation side, right? That should be the last thing we think of. If she had a GCS of 15, that shouldn't play into our decision-making. And I think that that's where we really have to kind of move forward in our airway management, right? It's not GCS less than 8, innovate. It is, right, what's her overall ability to control her secretions? Can she follow your commands?
Absolutely.
And I think the biggest thing is, what is her clinical course? If she aspirates, right, that is a big, big deal. That's going to really, really increase her overall mortality rate. So we have to really think about the long-term effect. So obviously comes in, they're going to do a tox screen, they're going to draw labs. And so let's jump into the overall absorption. And, you know, she comes back, she has an aspirin level that is a little bit elevated. And so what's our normal absorption for aspirin, and why is it a tricky medication over other medications?
Sure thing. So the normal absorption for a therapeutic dose of aspirin, so remember the therapeutic dose is 10 to 30 milligrams per deciliter. That's the therapeutic dose of aspirin. The normal absorption for that is 15 to 20 minutes, and that goes through the gut. Right. So 15 to 20 minutes. The half-life of aspirin can be up to 20 plus hours. I think one of the things that we need to understand with an aspirin toxicology or toxidrome is that the overdose side of the aspirin toxicity can take up to 6 hours. So you mentioned earlier, you talked about they drew labs on her when she came into the emergency room. If that initial lab came back at 40 or 50, we would want to make sure that we check the aspirin level serially, so multiple times, due to the fact that you might see overdose symptoms in as long as 6 hours after the initial ingestion.
Or greater, because the half-life itself is up to 20 hours.
20 hours, yeah.
Right, so, and you said something very, very perfect, and I think if you, you know, if we don't understand the whole pharmacokinetics of the medication, that medication just sits in the gut, that second pass metabolism.
Yeah.
And this is one of those medications that, based on my teaching and learning, if you're 2 or 3 hours in and you know it's an aspirin overdose, still give activated charcoal. Still
Absolutely.
Do gastric lavage, right? Still try to get that off the stomach, because it's the absorption is slow. It's going to take a long time. It takes a long time for that medication to peak. You do that initial tox, as you said, it may come back perfectly normal, maybe 30, 40, which you're like, okay, well, that's a normal aspirin level. Well, what is it now, 6, 8 hours later?
Absolutely.
And I think that is where an aspirin overdose really has to be evaluated from a pure standpoint. You walk in and you have a patient that has altered mental status, is, we'll say, febrile, has a rapid respiratory rate. What else does that sound like?
So I was thinking about that earlier when we presented the initial case. Agitation, diaphoretic,
yeah,
tachycardic, tachypneic. The differential for that or those constellation of symptoms is very long. There are a lot of things that present like that.
Yeah, but I agree. And when you walk in and you see somebody that's febrile, they have a decreased mentation, they're diaphoretic, they're multed, they're tachycardic, that rings sepsis all day long.
Absolutely,
right?
Lack in perfusion.
Absolutely.
Sure thing.
And so that's where I really think providers, whether you're a paramedic, a nurse, a physician, a mid-level, it's easy to get sucked into that mindset. You know, and think back to the podcast I did with Ashley, and we did the whole second fracture.
Yeah.
You have to really stand back and look at things from a wide angle. It's really, really easy to, and it's not being complacent, but it is really easy to get sucked down a rabbit hole. And this is one of those overdoses that really mimics that sepsis, that infectious process.
Absolutely.
And before you realize it, your patient is in big trouble.
Absolutely. You could be chasing them with blood cultures and antibiotics and vasopressor therapy, and you're not treating the essence of their issue, which is the aspirin toxicity.
So based on the half-life up to 20 hours, let's talk about really quickly before we jump back into the, you know, the pathophysiology of the presentation of what are the different aspirin levels, what's this patient's current aspirin level, and let's compare that to a non-lethal level, a sick patient, and then they have a classification of a lethal level.
Sure thing. So I want to take us back to the beginning of the case, which we said 10 to 30 milligrams per deciliter of aspirin is the therapeutic level within the body, again, used for therapy. When you talk about a non-lethal dose, so how much aspirin can we take before we become in that range where we kind of get into that range of being lethal? So we'll start at the low end. Less than 150 milligrams per kilogram of aspirin is a non-lethal dose. 150 to 500 milligrams per kilogram will make you sick. That is likely where this patient is resting right now, probably in the 100s to 150 range. Over 500 milligrams per kilogram of aspirin is considered a lethal dose. There is very little chance that that patient is going to make a full recovery if you are over 500 milligrams per kilogram. So let's go ahead and take these numbers and put them into relatable, what we can visualize as the actual pills, the 81 milligram tablet. If this patient weighed 80 kilograms, if you were to take 150 milligrams per kilogram, multiply that by 80 kilos, that comes out to 12 grams of aspirin. 12 grams of aspirin. If you divide that by 81 milligrams, that gives you 148 pills. And that's on the low side.
That's on the low side, yeah. So, I mean, think about how small baby aspirin are. I'm just thinking baby aspirin. You know, some of us, like Ashley, let's just throw this out there. She has a hard time taking one vitamin.
Mm-hmm.
I can take a handful of eight in one gulp, and I can drink, and I can swallow all of them. Right?
Yeah.
She can't do that. So I always think of it like, man, I could probably take a whole bottle, swallow it, you know, and have no problem. So it would be very, very easy.
Sure thing.
So let's compare that to the 500 milligrams per kilo.
Absolutely. So now you take 500 milligrams per kilo, you multiply that by 80 kilograms. That's 40 grams of aspirin. Now you divide that by 81 milligram tablets. That gives you 493 pills. If your average, like, container from a Walmart contains 500 pills, that would be the entire bottle.
Yeah.
493 pills. So that just puts it, I think, into kind of a grand view, right? Something that we can relate to when we see the actual medication and the container.
Absolutely. And I think when we kind of segue and move, you know, to discussion points with this, I think the things that we need to highlight is, number one, aspirin overdose. I mean, when we go back to this case, again, altered mental status, agitation, rapid respirations, remember, think about in any differential, what is something that sticks out? You know, and I say this in different presentations we talk about in the review class, whether those are cardiac, what is something that sticks out, a red flag that sticks up, that triggers your memory every single time? And for me, the rapid respirations, right?
Absolutely.
For me, it's like, okay, well, it could be definitely sepsis. It definitely could be something ingestion-wise.
Yep. Could be a shock-type state.
Absolutely. So this is all about a benign presentation. Very, very easy to miss. Number two, hyperventilation. Red flag. High respiratory rate with no hypoxia.
Absolutely.
So we talk about that always in our courses, is the difference between what's called venous admixture and dead space ventilation. And I often throw the word shunt out there, and there's always questions, what is shunt? Shunt is essentially, in the simplest form, you have two forms of delivery of oxygen, or you have two parts of DO2. DO2, the delivered oxygen, is equal to the content of oxygen in our arterial blood multiplied by a cardiac output, right? So you have to deliver the oxygen down to the alveolar capillary level, and you have to deliver it with cardiac output.
Absolutely.
Right? They each work independently, but they work cohesively together to ultimately deliver oxygen. So when you have a high respiratory rate, despite no hypoxia, what we always see with these shunts, and again, when we say shunt, do we have an inability to deliver the oxygen? Do you have some type of pneumonia? Do you have capillary leakage based on some inflammatory response?
Sure thing.
Or do you have a perfusion-related anomaly, right? And the most severe would be classified as a shunt related to dead space ventilation. So why would somebody have a high respiratory rate that's not hypoxic? And oftentimes we see a patient with an ABG in a shunt state where they have a uncompensated respiratory alkalosis.
Yeah.
With hypoxemia, right?
Absolutely.
In this case, they're not going to have the hypoxemia. The PaO2 is going to be normal.
Sure thing.
So that is something that we definitely need to think about. One little trick you can do at the bedside, just as a pearl, and I'm all about these little tricks, is you can take a standard average atmospheric pressure of 700 torr or 700 millimeters of mercury, multiply it by your FiO2. So let's say this patient is on an FiO2 of 50%. So it'd be 700 times 0.50 minus 50. If they are on an FiO2 of 50%, they should have a PaO2 of 300. That's a
sure
quick
thing.
Bedside, calculation for the average person, for the average area, right? Obviously, the normal sea level atmospheric pressure of 760, so we're using 700. So 700 torr times the FiO2 minus 50 torr. So we always do, right, the order of operations. So
sure thing.
If you were going to write this out in a formula, you would have 700 torr times FiO2 in parentheses. Minus 50 torr on the outside.
Yeah, so that's a great tool. Trick. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So based on that thought process, when we look at the continuation of labs, the aspirin level came back at 99.4. Milligrams per deciliter. Remember, as far as measurements go, you know, it's hard for us to compute, but a deciliter is 100 mils.
Sure thing.
So we're saying 99.4 milligrams per deciliter. The ABG, so pH currently is 7.22. PaCO2 is 19, and the bicarb is 11. So we would classify that if we go through our step-by-step approach. We look at the pH. We ask ourselves, what is the first name? If the pH lands between 7.35 and 7.45, we're compensated. If it's outside of that range, we are uncompensated is our first name. So we are definitely uncompensated as far as that. If we are less than 7.4, we are acidotic. If we're greater than 7.4, we're alkalotic. So we're definitely less than 7.4. So our first name is going to be uncompensated. Last name is going to be acidosis. Then we look at the cause. What's the cause? We could have a respiratory cause. We could have a metabolic cause. Respiratory is a CO2. And we know our normal CO2 level is 35 to 45, and we are low. CO2 is what's called a frank acid. So we would want to have a higher amount of CO2 to have a reflection of acidosis on the respiratory side, which we don't. We have a lower. So we are in a respiratory alkalosis as a secondary part of this. And our bicarb is 11, and bicarbs should be between 22 and 26. Bicarb is a base. High bicarb equals more base. Low bicarb means we have more acid. So this is always the trickiest one to teach. What I always tell every class, every time I teach this, if you have a acidotic pH and you have an acidotic bicarb, once the bicarb is affected, it runs everything. It is the leader of the pack. You should always have a difference, an opposite change in your what your kidneys are doing, bicarb. Bicarb is showing acidosis.
Sure thing.
And what your
lungs are doing.
Lungs are doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because your respiratory system is the secondary buffering system. Carbonic is first, respiratory is second. So essentially, if we were thinking about the acid-base formula, what you're seeing right now in the acid-base formula is you have all this excess hydrogen. You have all this excess bicarb floating around. Your respiratory system is recognizing this. It's combining those two, forming carbonic acid. That formula is moving to the right. Carbonic acid does not like to stay carbonic acid. It splits off into CO2, which our respiratory system can exhale, and water, which can be evaporated or reabsorbed.
Sure thing.
So that's what's happening. This would be classified as a partially compensated metabolic acidosis. And we call it partially compensated because if you correct the CO2, the CO2, remember, is 19. If we make that CO2 40, what's going to happen to the pH? Remember, for every 10-point change in CO2, you have an opposite change of 0.08 in our pH.
Yep, in the pH.
So if we brought our CO2 up to 29 from 19, our pH would drop by 0.08. We would down be in
1.4-ish.
Yeah, somewhere in there. So the important thing to know is we are in a partially compensated metabolic acidosis. So let's talk about the respiratory side of things, because I think that's what's very complex about this type of overdose, is that you're going to have this hyperthermic response. You're going to have temperatures maybe exceeding 104, right? Why does that happen? Why is this patient in this respiratory alkalosis? So let's jump into that.
Yeah, sure thing. So great teaching points there. I think this patient especially, would be presenting as a hypermetabolic patient. Their temperature is high. Their respiratory rate is high. Their heart rate is high. Let's specifically focus on, for now, the elevated respiratory rate. I think that's an imperative piece here. The high respiratory rate is really from a respiratory, it puts you into a respiratory alkalosis because you're blowing off CO2 in compensation. The issue that we really need to focus on is why. So aspirin is a neurotoxic drug that stimulates the cardiorespiratory center in your brain. That causes the high respiratory rate. That goes back to what you were talking about earlier, which is you have a high respiratory rate, but not necessarily hypoxic. Again, that should be a red flag when Absolutely. You see that to say something's not right here. Something else is going on. Critical thinking, let's push a little bit further. The hyperthermia is usually related to the hypermetabolism, stimulation of the thermosensitive neurons in that area. Again, neurotoxicity, which interestingly enough is also one of the another interesting symptom of these patients, which can be tinnitus or ringing in their ear. And that's also from the neurotoxicity. So you have the patient in a respiratory alkalosis because of the high respiratory rate. However, the patient suffering from an aspirin overdose is really in a high anion gap metabolic acidosis, which we just talked about after analyzing her ABG.
Yeah, so when we look at that high anion gap metabolic acidosis, if you ever get asked a question on an exam, they will ask you specifically about aspirin overdose, and they'll ask you, what is the metabolic derangement related to this? And really, there's two sides of this. Number one, an uncompensated respiratory alkalosis. Number two, a partially compensated metabolic acidosis, right? That's more of a late part of this. And that's because you have what's called an uncoupling based on essentially a blockade in the Krebs cycle. And so it causes an uncoupling of what we call oxidative phosphorylation. So, you know, I teach this in the review class, one of my favorite subjects. We always say the electron transport chain. That is a part of that last process. Oxidative phosphorylation is basically two words that describe aerobic respiration.
Sure.
Right. So yeah. If you ever get asked a question during aerobic respiration, how many ATP do you produce? You could also say during oxidative phosphorylation, how many ATP do you produce?
You can use those terms interchangeably.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The correct biological term is oxidative phosphorylation. Oxidation is essentially taking an O2 molecule, gaining hydrogen ions and forming water. Essential to stay for us to stay in homeostasis.
Sure thing.
Phosphorylation is the phosphorus gaining a third phosphorus, right? ADP, adenosine diphosphate, turning into adenosine
ATP.
Triphosphate.
Yeah.
So essentially, when you say uncoupling oxidative phosphorylation, you're stopping that process and you're causing a buildup, right? You can't metabolize the hydrogen ions. Hydrogen ions are acidic. We start having a big, big problem. And so you have a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. Remember, anion gaps should be less than 20 in a corrected state. If it's uncorrected, most hospital labs will say less than 12. Some hospital labs maybe a little bit lower than that. But the important thing, if you have a high anion gap, and that high anion gap is, we're saying 35, 40, that's very, very synonymous to a toxic metabolite.
Absolutely.
Right? You're going to be looking at an osmolar gap. You're going to be looking way down the line in identification. What is this? And we already know, based on the aspirin level, that the aspirin level is very, very high. Right.
Sure thing.
But you're not going to know this. Again, that's where you have to look at that benign presentation. We already gave you the answer because I think there's so many facets of an aspirin overdose. I just wanted to get right to the point that this is an aspirin overdose. Patient took a whole bunch of aspirin, has a long history, and we have to be able to clue in on that. The other aspect to this is these patients can actually also be in a metabolic alkalosis, right? And that's what just blows my mind, right? This gets so complex. We're talking about respiratory alkalosis. You're talking about metabolic
acidosis, and then you're bringing in a metabolic alkalosis.
Right, and that is strictly because of the vomiting.
Sure right? thing. So these patients often have profuse gastric emptying, and that eliminates acid from your system. So that puts you into a metabolic alkalosis. The other piece here that I think is important that goes along with the vomiting is that you also lose potassium. So there's a frank hypokalemia that comes along with kind of hooked onto the train of an aspirin overdose. And the low potassium level or the derangement in the potassium level is going to become important when we start talking about the treatment for the aspirin overdose. And that's specifically when we talk about alkalization of the urine.
Right. So do you want to jump into that? So obviously sodium bicarbonate administration is one of those treatments. We've talked about this in other podcasts, that sodium bicarbonate administration is not always the end-all be-all. It needs to be very focused. Certain types of overdoses, things like that, maybe pHs on a lower end. But obviously we can mix that in a different level and not get the whole CO2 component that we would get it with 8.4%, right? You can dilute that down and
absolutely
do 4.2, and I've talked about that in other podcasts. But talk about the whole hydrogen ions and how in this state that causes a problem with alkalizing the urine.
Sure thing. So you would typically use bicarbonate mixed in dextrose 5%, and that's how you would administer that. And you're administering that for the purposes of alkalizing the urine. But let's bring this back to the potassium. So potassium and hydrogen, in terms of the molecular construction, look very similar, and they're very, very small molecules. So the kidney is kind of in a funk. It doesn't know how to separate out the potassium versus the hydrogen ions. So the body says our potassium is low. It starts holding on to a little bit of potassium, but continues to secrete out the hydrogen ions, making your urine acidotic. And so when you give sodium bicarb, essentially you're just combating the acidotic urine. So you're not really alkalizing the urine truly. You're really just neutralizing it. If you want to truly alkalize it, we need to fix the hypokalemia. And by administering parenteral or IV potassium, if we fix the hypokalemia, that'll allow us to hold on to both the hydrogen ion as well, and we can actually truly alkalize the urine with the sodium bicarbonate. So we can only truly fix the alkalization of the urine after we fix the low potassium. I think that's essential.
No, and that's absolutely correct. And I think that when you look at that specifically, we know that if you had to compare a hyper K state versus a low potassium state, right? A low potassium state is going to be a little bit more difficult to treat.
Sure thing.
Slow rise. You don't get a lot of bang for your buck. Every 10 milliequivalents you give, you basically get a 0.1 increase. So have to be on top of your labs. You have to check these labs continuously. So when we look at critical care transport, you know, this is definitely going to be one of those small hospitals. Patient comes in.
Absolutely.
You know, physician has done everything that they can do. They've done all the labs. They've started these treatments. You as a flight crew or a ground transport crew taking this patient, you're going to be given these labs. You may have a situation where maybe the potassium hasn't been started, right? And that's not a knock on any provider, but I mean, sometimes this stuff is not their wheelhouse.
Absolutely.
You could have a family practice doc that is moonlighting in a small critical access hospital, and that's just not their thing, right? They haven't messed with aspirin overdoses in 30 years.
In years, yeah.
So that's where you have to understand this stuff, and I think that's where you have to say, hey, we need to start some K.
Sure thing. I think you need to advocate for your patients. So you may see a provider that says, let's fix, because it's an aspirin overdose, we know that they're in an acidotic state, let's give the sodium bicarb, and that becomes the primary focus, when yet their potassium might be 3.1. You're gonna chase the alkalization of the urine a lot longer than if you simply fix the potassium first and then continue the sodium bicarbonate treatment.
Yeah. So when we look at this case and kind of segue further into this case, at 8 hours, the aspirin actually came back at 486. So we have a significant rise. Mental status, when we look at mental status, I think the other thing I want to talk about is, even though the aspirin level skyrockets like this, at one point, do you intubate the patient? Well, we talked about, you know, can they follow commands? Can they control secretions? That's going to be a provider decision.
Sure thing.
I mean, I'm not going to push you in one way. I will tell you this, that I have always been, I wouldn't say aggressive, but that is just something for me that I feel more comfortable if I had my family in front of me, and I would do this for my family. If my wife was in front of me and I had to take care of her and she could not control her secretions, would I let her lay there and say, oh, I don't want to put her through an intubation because I just I'm an innovator.
Absolutely.
I really am. I mean, yeah. I really, really think of it in that way. I feel more comfortable controlling that airway. I feel comfortable with my intubation skills and then putting her on a mechanical ventilator. With that being said, if you have a patient, and I think this is one of those other big pearls that I think is pretty amazing. We always talk about our blood glucose level.
Sure thing.
We do capillary blood glucose checks. We always, you know, depending on your protocol, infants, neonates, we always say less than 40. You know, I mean, whether you're using a protocol that says less than 80, less than 70, whatever that is,
sure thing.
You know, it doesn't really matter. Ultimately, some patient that has a glucose level of 70 may have an altered mentation. You may have somebody that has a 22 that is slightly, right? You
absolutely.
Just never know. Everybody's different.
Presents very differently, sure thing.
But we have to understand, and I want you to explain as best you can, there is a difference with what's called CNS hypoglycemia and a normal capillary blood glucose. And so what you'll see a lot of times, because of the whole aspect of uncoupling oxidative phosphorylation and affecting glycolysis, is you're going to see a patient with an altered mentation that will have a perfectly normal blood glucose level, but
absolutely.
That has a critically low central nervous system hypoglycemia.
Let's talk a little bit about the low blood sugar. And here we have to talk about the difference between the systemic or system-wide blood glucose level that we obtain via the capillary draw versus the blood glucose level within the cerebrum. And this is called neuroglycopenia, so a low level of glucose within the cranium. And that is classic, again, of an aspirin overdose, neuroglycopenia. So you could draw a capillary finger stick and get a blood sugar of 100 milligrams per deciliter, yet they are presenting continuously with an altered mental status, and that is driven by the neuroglycopenia. So I think that's an important concept to bring out and for people to understand, is that you might be looking at this entire list of differentials. Let's remember that the low blood sugar levels in the brain are giving them the altered mental status along with the neurotoxicity of the aspirin overdose. But if we were to check a systemic or capillary blood sugar, that would be normal.
Yeah, so I think, you know, when you look at some of these cases, I've seen cases where it's been highlighted where blood glucose levels were exceeding 100 and altered mental status. They gave an AMPA D50 and patient woke up.
Sure thing.
So I think that is very, very important that this is what highlights critical care.
Sure thing.
It is.
Absolutely.
Remember, you can't be black or white. This is a great, great point right here of you have to understand the pathophysiology of a disease process. It's not always, if blood sugar is less than 80, you may have altered mental status, right?
Yeah.
Altered mental status protocol really is very, very cookbook.
Sure.
There are so many things about that. So we have to understand that a aspirin overdose is going to cause this phenomenon. If your patient is altered, even if their sugar is normal,
give
them an AMPA D50.
Absolutely. A couple other things that I think we mentioned earlier, but we should really talk about. You can also see pulmonary edema from the permeable vascular space within the lungs. There can be coagulopathies. There can be cerebral edema that you see. Certain types of dysrhythmias you may also see, but those are not as common as you will see with the hyperthermia, the hyperventilation, the tachypnea, the tachycardia, et cetera. The other thing that I was going to call out, we should call out ginger right now. We're talking about 50 Shades of Gray. We're talking about black and white. The art of medicine, wasn't that our keynote talk at Fast 19?
Yeah, absolutely.
So kind of driving some of those concepts home.
When we continue and we look at secondary ABGs, pH continued to drop. pH currently now is 7.03. PaCO2 is 19, bicarb is 7, and on gap is up to 36. So what I've talked about in other podcasts if you have a high anion gap metabolic acidosis and you have a bicarb less than 10, again, one of those red flags. Think about a big red flag. That is a toxic substance. We already said at 8 hours, aspirin was at 486. In this case, they did start bicarb administration at 2 to 3 mils per hour. They
administered, I think, some calcium, gave the patient some IV potassium as well. Again, we already talked about that, making sure that we do true alkalization of the urine to correct the metabolic acidosis that's going on. So I have a question for you, Eric. In terms of mechanical ventilation, if this patient had a respiratory rate of like 30s, let's say, and you are going to control their airway, you're going to put them on the ventilator, would you try to change their respiratory rate back to normal parameters, or would you try to keep it at the same rate and match what they were doing during their time of compensation during the disease process? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, great question. This is one of those things that I think, again, we can get really kind of tunnel vision on, is that when you have a high respiratory rate, we got to make sure that, you know, and I talk about this in the review classes, we've done a podcast in the past, think about the three P's of end-tidal CO2. Number one, pulse. Do they have a pulse?
Sure.
Number two, do they have a perfusion-related anomaly? And what we're doing by the three P's of end-tidal CO2 is we're identifying what is causing that end-tidal to be low. If this end-tidal, obviously we know the rules, if their PaCO2 is 19, their end-tidal is lower than 19.
Sure thing.
Right? So their end-tidal could be 15. Why is that 15? Well, are they alive?
So do they have a pulse?
Right, do they have a pulse?
That's the first thing.
Number two, what's their perfusion-related status? Remember, get rid of blood pressure from your mind. It's all about mean arterial pressure.
Sure thing.
Do they have a MAP that's perfusing? So 60, 65. I prefer 65.
Sure thing.
And then lastly, what's their pH? Well, we know that they're already severely acidotic. And if they're severely acidotic, they're in a partially compensated metabolic acidosis. That means that they're hyperventilating in a way to compensate. And we already
Absolutely.
Know, we've already explained that reason. So they need a high minute ventilation. So there's a couple ways to think about this. In previous teachings, in really some of the old podcasts based on Scott Weingard's teaching, I taught 240 mils per kilo per minute. Talking to Dan Davis, our medical director and the scientific advisor for our methods, he is truly thinking that more of a 160 mils per kilo per minute is probably more in line. So that's probably a respiratory rate around 26. I think the easiest way is to really try to identify what is their end-tidal CO2 at the time of intubation. Put a nasal cannula end-tidal CO2 on.
Absolutely.
Identify what that is. Obviously, it's going to tell you, and you're going to match that. You're going to try to achieve that with your minute ventilation. If they're breathing 36 times a minute before you intubate them, that's the respiratory rate you need to set them on.
Sure thing.
That doesn't mean we need to lower the overall tidal volume down to super, super low numbers. I think you could lower it down to 4 mils per kilo, but you have to think about what is their normal physiologic tidal volume. It's going to be between 4 and 600.
Absolutely.
If they're breathing at 4 to 600 at 36 times a minute, you need to match that.
Sure thing.
Right? And that is absolutely fine. That doesn't mean you need to set a mandatory rate at 36, set it at 18 and let them contribute 18.
Absolutely.
Right? They want to do this. I mean, if you've never had a patient like this, you are not going to be able to sedate them to a point where they don't want to do this. They're wanting to contribute, and let them contribute.
Sure thing.
This is not a respiratory failure type of a situation.
Absolutely. Well, and I think it goes back to the beginning of the case when we talked about aspirin being neurotoxic and stimulating the cardiorespiratory center. It's down a completely different track. So that was a great answer. Awesome.
Yeah, so I think, again, let's highlight some things. Number one, remember benign presentation. Remember, you have to look at those red flags. Patient comes in, you know, mental status is altered, agitation, rapid respirations. Rapid respirations is what I'm focusing on. Why does somebody have rapid respirations? And then we start looking at asking questions. Is this patient suicidal? Has this patient had past suicidal indications? Have they done this in the past? And then we get into the case where they draw the labs. All right, we have an aspirin level that's a little bit higher than therapeutic. All right. Well, we know based on second pass metabolism and how that medication just kind of sits in the gut that very likely, based on the half-life of 20 hours, that you're going to have a super high spike, and we do. Remember that there's, you know, we just talked about aspirin. We talked about Pepto-Bismol. We talked about, you know, oil of wintergreen, Excedrin. There's a lot of medications
that have aspirin.
Yeah, we just named a few of those. You know, if they get a temperature of over 104 based on this type of presentation, you have a high aspirin level, you need to cool them off.
Absolutely.
Right? You got to cool them off. Decreased LOC, diaphoresis, molted skin, that tachycardia, all of those things really look like sepsis. They all look like a hyperdynamic response. When I've read case reports on aspirin overdoses, that's usually what the provider talks about is they got sucked down that rabbit hole. It's real easy to do that. We can all do that. So benign presentation, hyperventilation, red flag, high respiratory rate despite no hypoxia. High minute ventilation. Why is somebody needing high minute ventilation? When I think about high minute ventilation, like truly high minute ventilation problems, DKA.
Absolutely.
We often talk about, and I've had this discussion with Dan Davis, he highlighted three types of acidosis that would truly cause high minute ventilation. Right, we always talk about metabolic acidosis.
Yep.
That is such a loosely used term that is not correct. It is not correct. Yeah. It's number one, it's going to be a patient in toxic glycol overdose. So ethylene glycol, propylene glycol.
Sure thing.
Number two, aspirin overdose. Number three, ketoacidosis. That's it.
Those three that cause a high minute ventilation.
In most cases, right? Yeah. We know that every patient
there's outliers.
But those are the three. But we always talk about those partially compensated states, and you're going to have this underlying respiratory alkalosis, and you're going to have this high minute ventilation, and any metabolic acidosis needs to have a high. That's not the case, guys.
Sure thing.
So unfortunately, this patient ended up in the ICU. They put her on dialysis. You know, that's something we really haven't addressed. But any toxic levels of aspirin overdose are going to be dialyzed.
Dialyzed out.
And this patient died 24 hours later. So hopefully this case was beneficial. There's a lot of questions on the advanced certification exams related to aspirin overdoses and the metabolic derangements. This is a very, very complex overdose, a lot of different aspects. And so go back to listen to these podcasts. You know, when we talk about the acidosis rodeo part 1, 2, and 3, I can't stress how important the understanding of those processes are. Huge in so many different levels. Understanding cellular respiration, understanding oxidative phosphorylation and the terminology related to that. Do you have anything to add?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. In order to maintain life, it's all about acid-base regulation, right? That is key to maintaining life. Homeostasis, that's a basic core principle of biology.
Absolutely. So we're going to wrap this up. If you have any questions related to this podcast, please email me at eric.bauer@flightbridget.com or bruce@bruce.hoffman@flightbridget.com. Again, thank you so much for believing in Flight Bridget, believing in our mission, for believing in what we do on a day-to-day basis. If you have any ideas for podcasts, you have any new cases, we love to hear your thoughts, your testimonials, your stories. And we just thank you.
Yeah, thank those that support Flight Bridget. It's a good world out there.
Absolutely. So on behalf of all of our staff, we thank you, and we'll talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridget Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.